along with Friendship Place, an evening on homelessness in the D.C. area. And there are going to be 9 churches who are a part of this. So at 6:30, there'll be a reception, and I believe the program starts at 7. I'm looking for, is that right, Sally? Yes? Okay. And the moderator tomorrow evening is one of our neighbors, Ray Suarez, who sometimes you might watch on the News Hour at 7 o'clock at night on public television. And so that should be a great event tomorrow evening. I want to read from you the 20th chapter of Exodus. The scene is Mount Sinai. The audience is Moses. Then God spoke all these words, and I'm just going to read the beginning. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. As Christians, and as part of the Abrahamic faiths, I suppose, we worship a God whose signature identity is to free those who are captive. God rescued Israel from slavery in Egypt and formed them into a people to bear witness to his mercy and righteousness to all nations. The Apostle Paul teaches that in Jesus Christ, Christians are delivered from spiritual slavery and adopted as God's children, enabling us to call God Abba, Father. Our topic tonight, the third in our spring series on biblical justice, is slavery. The issue is as current as today's headlines, or in the case of the Washington Post, yesterday's Metro section. Perhaps you saw the piece by Petula Dvorak entitled, Woman Escapes Modern-Day Slavery in a Home Near the Nation's Capital. To help us explore this topic tonight, we have a panel of experts, many of whom have connections one way or another to people right here at National Presbyterian Church. Amanda Walker Rodriguez is an assistant state's attorney in Baltimore County and a member of the Maryland Human Trafficking Task Force. Since 2007, she has been working on sex trafficking cases. She is assigned an average of 30 a year just in trafficking, and she ends up prosecuting about 10 a year. Recently prosecuted one where the sentence was 35 years in prison. She may look young to have accomplished so much, but the fact that she is one of the youngest women to pass the Maryland State Bar exam has something to do with that. And the fact that I know that is because, well, she is a legend around here, or something of a legend around here at National among our staff, as she is the daughter of our colleague Jim Walker, our director of facilities. Veronica Zeitlin McKenna works for the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. There, she is a counter-trafficking in persons advisor. She manages programs and develops policies to combat human trafficking in the developing world. Prior to joining USAID, she worked at the U.S. State Department's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons, where she monitored the problem of human trafficking in 23 sub-Saharan African countries, and worked with foreign government officials and civil society activists to combat it. She attended law school at Columbia University, and she is a deacon here at National Presbyterian Church, and a former colleague of our person right to my right, Mark Taylor. He is the senior coordinator to monitor and combat trafficking in persons for the State Department. That's the United States State Department. And he has led the reporting and political affairs section of the State Department's Trafficking in Persons Office since 2003, making this his 10th year, I suppose, to write the report to the State Department. He coordinates the production of this annual Trafficking in Persons report and manages the department's diplomatic engagement on human trafficking issues around the world. And this is a really busy time of year for him. I suppose it's always a busy time for him, but this is particularly, and we are very grateful that he has made time to be with us. Many of you may know Mark through his parents, Clyde and Ginny Taylor, who are longtime members of this church, and Mark has been a good friend to this congregation over the years. Jim Martin is Vice President of Church Mobilization for International Justice Mission. Many of you know that IJM is a human rights agency that secures justice for victims of slavery, sexual exploitation, and other forms of violent oppression in countries around the world. Jim helps churches move to a deeper level of understanding of God's heart for justice and the action to which Christians are called on behalf of the many victims of injustice around the world. His book, The Just Church, A Practical Guide for Life-Giving Justice Ministry, is available for purchase on the book table this evening on your way out. Don't go now. Also available is a general book on the topic of biblical justice by Jim Skillen, also a friend of this congregation and a recent teacher in the Wrestler's class, A Covenant to Keep, Meditations on the Biblical Theme of Justice. If you're wondering what biblical justice is, these two books will give you great insight into it, and I commend them to you. To moderate our panel this evening, I've invited a friend of nearly 10 years, maybe longer, can't count that high. His name is Joe Farrell. Joe is an ordained Presbyterian minister who, like Nancy and me, moved to Washington after serving on the staff of First Presbyterian Church of Colorado Springs. And he now works for International Justice Mission, recently becoming the Northeast Director for Church Mobilization at IJM. Before I turn everything over to Joe to moderate, I want to remind you of how we're going to handle questions at the end. You have lavender cards on your seats. There are some on the back table where the refreshments are. If you would like to ask a question, get a card, write it down, and if you'll signal during the course of the event, I'll be on the lookout and try to pick them up so that when we get to the end of our panel's time, there'll be a time for questions and answer. Friends, welcome. Joe, it's yours.
Well, thank you all for coming. You all know the phrase of last but not least, right? Well, Quinn did last and least in his order of introductions. We have a great panel. I'm excited to hear what they have to say. And so just want to give you a picture of where we're going for the night, kind of the narrative that we want to tell, and that I'm going to ask them questions. I've asked each of them to, if they have an extra comment, and even though the question's not been addressed specifically to them, that they might have a comment to add just to get my attention. That is being recorded, just so for all of you not to say anything that might be confidential or classified in your questions, and the panelists all know that as well. But National will have this as something to continue to share and to give. You also might not want to do anything embarrassing yourself then that way, knowing that they'll have you on tape if you do that. So the narrative for the night is, first we're going to frame the issue. What does human trafficking mean? Is it slavery? Is it something different? So we want to kind of define all of that and get a little snapshot pictures of what it looks like globally and locally. Then we want to move into really what does this issue mean and how does it intersect with what it means to be a Christian? Why should a Christian care about this? What's motivated people to do this work, and is there any overlap in their faith? And then finally, what we're going to end with is a little bit about what does it mean for a specific church or to be involved in this work, or how might a church or a group of people get involved in fighting human trafficking together. And we're going to try to do all that by 7:45, which will then leave 15 minutes for questions from you all. So that's where your questions will come in, and if you don't have any, then I just have to keep coming up with them. So, and I do have some good ones ready for that, but we'd love to have questions from you as well. So let's start right in with this idea of human trafficking. You've heard that phrase, and Quinn mentioned the word slavery and talking about that in his biblical text. So Veronica, would you please give us a sense of what does it mean? How does USAID and how did your experience in the TIP office? So give us some sense of what human trafficking means in the world today.
Great. Thank you, Joe. Before I talk about the definition of trafficking, I'd just be curious to see maybe a show of hands. How many people here have had some exposure to this issue, either through a course you've taken or maybe you've volunteered for an NGO or had some sort of exposure in your own work environment? Has anyone here? Okay, so there are.
Indirectly?
Okay, so there are a few people. That's great. So human trafficking, which is also called modern-day slavery, is a situation where traffickers use force, fraud, or coercion to exploit a person for profit through forced labor or prostitution. So a typical scenario could be a trafficker saying to somebody, I've got a great job opportunity for you as a waitress in an establishment. You'll make lots of money. Come with me. The person goes with them. And when they get there, it is an establishment. It is a job as a waitress. But guess what? We're not going to pay you. You're going to work under guard. If you try to leave, we'll find you. We'll kill you. At night, you're locked up with other restaurant laborers in squalid conditions. If you've come from a foreign country to this work site, very often your travel documents are taken away. That would be one labor trafficking situation. For a sex trafficking situation, a sexual slavery situation, it could be the same scenario, but when the person goes with the trafficker, the site turns out to be a prostitution house, a brothel, right? So the person isn't working as a waitress. The person is forced into prostitution. So in trafficking, there always has to be either force, fraud, or coercion. So the person who's being exploited is not consenting to the work situation or to the prostitution. That's kind of the heart of the issue. There is one exception, however, to the requirement for force, fraud, or coercion. Does anybody have any idea what that is? That is, that's a minor in prostitution. So under U.S. law and international law, anyone under the age of 18 who is in prostitution, where there's a third party who profits, is automatically a trafficking victim, because we've determined that anyone who's 17 or less really can't consent, is not mature enough to consent to prostitution. Another definitional issue is about movement. There is a misconception often that movement is required for trafficking to occur. So a lot of the cases that we hear about involve somebody taken by a trafficker from one country to the next, or even within a country from a rural area to an urban area. And so that's very often the case, that movement is a part of trafficking, but it's actually not a required element. Trafficking can occur in your own neighborhood. Your neighbor can call you up and fraud you, deceive you, and say, come on over for a party, and then, of course, you're forced into prostitution or something like that, even in your own community. So, and then I just want to mention that trafficking manifests in so many different ways that there's really no one victim profile. For example, we talked about the example of the restaurant industry. Well, forced labor happens not just in the restaurant industry, it happens in construction and fishing and agriculture. So you can have, a 40-year-old man who's a trafficking victim in the construction industry. You can have 6-year-old child who's in forced labor on a farm in Africa. You can have a young woman who's educated, college educated in Eastern Europe, who's trafficked for sex, having been lured into what she thought was a job in Western Europe. So trafficking victims come in all ages, and they're male and female. And finally, I thought that I would just share with you some quick statistics about the issue. First of all, just a caveat. Statistics are really tough in this field because it's very hard to collect data about trafficking victims because they're a hidden population. It's a crime, it's a clandestine activity, and traffickers work hard to hide their victims. And even when victims escape or if they're rescued, they don't usually report themselves to authorities because they feel shame, they're traumatized, they're worried about the stigma, if anyone should know what they've been subjected to. So it's very hard to get numbers for trafficking victims, but the International Labor Organization has really sort of done the best job out there of creating a methodology to come up with a global estimate. So their global estimate is that there are 20.9 million sex and labor trafficking victims in the world at any given time. There's also another estimate from an anti-trafficking expert named Kevin Bales, And his own estimate is 27 million. So we really think the real number is somewhere between that, and maybe that's just scratching the surface, right? Because the victims are so hard to find. According to the International Labor Organization, 55% of victims are women and girls, and the remainder are men and boys. And adults represent an estimated 74% of victims. Children, of course, represent 26% of victims. And so the ILO categorizes victims into those who are exploited in the private economy, so in all of these labor sectors that we've talked about, as well as the commercial sex industry. 90% of victims globally are exploited in the private economy, and the remaining 10% are in state-imposed forms of forced labor, such as prisons, or state military, or victimized by rebel armed groups. Of that 90% in the private economy, 22% are victims of sex trafficking, while 68% are victims of labor trafficking. And I just wanted to mention that because we hear much more about the sex trafficking victims than we do about the labor trafficking and victims. But in fact, the vast majority globally of trafficking victims are actually in forced labor. And also, if my colleagues, if I left anything out and you want to add anything, please do.
Well, Veronica, that was very helpful. Thank you. We need to get those traffickers to report them, right? That would be helpful for us. They gave us accurate numbers, accounts. So obviously a huge global problem. Jim, give us a sense of what human trafficking looks like from a global perspective and who is affected by it in your experience with IJM.
Sure. Thanks very much. Just a few more statistics. A global picture might be helped by a couple more numbers. One thing would be to say that estimates say that human trafficking on an annual basis is a $32 billion a year industry. So anything that has that size of an economic engine behind it is actually going to be quite challenging to fight. It's also, human trafficking, also the third largest illicit form of trafficking behind drug trafficking and arms trafficking, but also reputed to be the fastest growing. So those are some huge global numbers. Who's affected by this? In our experience, we're an organization of that is on the ground in about 10 different countries in 16 different field offices, directly engaging in many of these offices in issues of labor and sex trafficking. And the challenge is, or the nightmare deepens, maybe we should say, when we understand actually who the victims are, because the victims overwhelmingly are the world's poor. And what emerges in the story is the reality that the world's poor are actually suffering a hidden epidemic of violence. So they are able to be exploited and trafficked simply because someone around them is more powerful than they are. And the issue of violence is often hard to comprehend for people that live in a state that includes a reasonably healthy rule of law sort of in the environment, right? But recently, the World Bank came out with a report that said 4.5 billion people in our world today, more than half of the world's population, live outside of the reach of rule of law. So if you're poor in the world and you're vulnerable, there's no one you can access to come to your help. There's no state-sponsored, coercive form of justice that can be delivered to you if someone more powerful around you is abusing you. So for 4.5 billion people in our world, their basic issue is that they're not safe. They're vulnerable to things like labor trafficking and sex trafficking and these very simple ruses that can pull them in their vulnerability into even worse situations in these significant nightmares. So that's where IJM is in the world, in the places where there is no 911 phone call to make, and no legitimate state-sponsored coercive force that can get in between the abuser and their victim.
Right. Okay, thank you, Jim. And so big issue, obviously global and global poor, but does this really happen in our own backyards? And that's what, Amanda, give us a sense of what the local trafficking issue is about and help us understand that from your perspective in Maryland.
Okay, well, I actually wrote an article. It was published by my law school, and it's called The Crime Next Door, Human Trafficking. And it's really something that people don't realize is happening right in front of them, mainly because the crime has changed from a period of time when there was no internet access. So before, you would see, let's say, prostitutes street walking on the street, and you would know what neighborhoods they were in, and you wouldn't go to those neighborhoods. But now it's prevalent on the internet. We have so many websites where these girls are being trafficked, and they don't even know it. I had a case very recently where the girl went in because they told her she was going to be a model, and they asked her to take pictures. She brought very special clothes. She was very excited. This is what she wanted to do with her life. She wanted to model. They took pictures, and before the police could even get there, because she actually ended up calling the police, they had posted her picture on the internet on a website called Backpage, which is a very prevalent sex trafficking website, and they had started to receive phone calls for this girl, and she didn't even know. She was sitting there thinking that she was having her pictures taken, that she was going to be a model, and they had already had numbers, men, set up to come in and see her, essentially. In Baltimore County specifically, which is where I work, we see two very different types of trafficking. In Maryland, I was explaining to some of my counterparts, there is no labor trafficking statute. We don't have it. We only have a sex trafficking statute. So those are the types of crimes that we see in Baltimore County. We have had a couple that are borderline labor trafficking. It's not to say that we don't have it in Baltimore County, but those have to be prosecuted under different statutes because we don't have it. The sex trafficking, we see underage girls or very, very young girls, 18, 19, 20-year-olds that are domestic. So they're girls that were born in the United States. Typically, they come from families that are broken or family. Foster care is a big problem in our county. We have the largest foster care system, the most foster care homes in Baltimore County. So that's the reason that we have the most victims of this type. These girls are exploited either by their families, their foster care families, their actual families, or they're going to shopping malls, and they're being picked up by men who say, here's my phone number, call me, I have work for you, oh, you're so pretty. Last year, or the year before, there was on the Metro, do you guys remember hearing about that case where there was a gentleman who was giving out a business card on the Metro, and he actually picked up some girls, and they were juveniles, and they were sex trafficked as a result of that. So it certainly exists right here in D.C. It exists in Baltimore. So these young girls are then taken to hotels. Often their licenses are taken away, their cell phones are taken away, and they don't know how to get out of the situation. They're young, and they're very impressionable, and they want to please people, and so they're forced into this system. If you have, and that we always go through, whenever I do trainings with my law enforcement, I ask the question, if you have hotels in the jurisdiction where you work, you have sex trafficking. If you have truck stops in the area where you live or where you work, you have sex trafficking. If you have massage parlors, and sometimes you don't even notice that they're in your neighborhood, but they're there. They're usually in homes. There may or may not be a sign out front. But if there's places where gentlemen go to get massages, you have sex trafficking. The 95 corridor is a major route for sex trafficking in the United States. The girls tend to start out in New York, they go all the way down to Miami, and all the stops in between. Well, Baltimore and D.C. are both on the 95 corridor. So in this area, you're going to have sex trafficking. And it's really a question of opening your eyes and seeing what's right in front of you. Because the issue is that a lot of the interaction between these gentlemen and these young girls, or these gentlemen and these boys, or women and boys, whatever you want to place them in this scenario, are happening directly in front of you. And you're just not knowing what you're seeing because it's not something that they want you to see. If they wanted you to see it, it would be out in the open. I want to talk about a specific instance. I went out with our HSI affiliates. We have a task force in Maryland that involves law enforcement and prosecution and victim services groups specifically for this issue. So I went out with our ICE agents, it's now called HSI, and they took me to Prince George's County, which is a stone's throw from here. They took me to a place where they said, just open your eyes as someone that recognizes this issue and tell me how many brothels you see. And it was an apartment complex, so I sat there, and I started to look around, and you noticed that there were gentlemen that were standing in the front of the apartment complexes, so in front of each of the doors, because it was an enclosed apartment building. And I was looking, and there were gentlemen standing at each one. I was like, that's interesting. So you look up at the windows, and there's gentlemen sitting in every other window. And I said, well, it looks like every single apartment is a brothel. And he said, that's exactly right. Every apartment in this apartment complex is a brothel. I went to University of Maryland to get my undergraduate degree, and it was maybe a half a mile from the college that I went to. My husband would walk. He went to a college that was just down the road from my college, and he would walk right by this apartment complex every single day. So we got back into the van, and we drove up to the next apartment complex, and he said, well, as someone that recognizes human trafficking, look around and tell me how many brothels you see. And it was the exact same thing. We then went inside of one, which was very eye-opening for someone that's never been inside of a brothel. But it was one of those things where if you don't know what you're looking for, sometimes you miss it. It's little things. These were the guards that were standing by, making sure that no police were going to come in. And it's one of those things where you really have to just recognize your surroundings and see what's happening right in front of you, because it is. Locally, I know that it was mentioned, but we have 30 investigations a year. I oversee all of our investigations. I have 5 detectives. Half of them do, well, not half, 4 of them do adults, and I have 1 that does children. So as far as sex trafficking in Baltimore, that's how many detectives they've given me to investigate these crimes. And we get 30 a year. I mean, that's a very large number. I know that it's hard sometimes to recognize that it's happening right in front of you, but it really is, and it's a problem. And hopefully, there are so many people here, and it's wonderful. We can really have some conversation as to how we can deal with it on a local level.
Mark, you have I would say one of your colleagues I had lunch with today. You know, Abe said just maybe one of the experts in trafficking in persons in the entire world in terms of knowledge. Do you have anything to add to this? And you mentioned to me the idea of the victim identification. What can you add to just help us understand this issue just a little bit more?
Well, you know, it's great to go last because I can build on so many great thoughts that have been raised. Victim identification is really the starting point for the effective response, whether it's by government, by NGOs, by church organizations, and yet it's the most difficult first step to make, as you've heard, because it really is hidden in plain sight. HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, ran a public awareness campaign that started several years ago that was entitled Look Beneath the Surface, and giving a number of images of vulnerable people, such as migrant workers, women on the street, and these are all people that could be trafficking victims, but you really need to take the next step and ask some questions, discover their situation. And this is what we're seeing all over the world is the challenges to making that connection. You heard the number 20.9 million as the estimate of victims that exist at any given time, and that's a very conservative figure. But we've been tracking the number of victims that have actually been found, and every year it never exceeds more than 49,000. So you can see the huge disparity between those who face this heinous problem and those who actually receive the hope of freedom and getting out of it. You know, looking at how traffickers operate, and there's not enough research that's done on this, it's not exactly fun work, but getting inside their head and how they victimize people, we've seen a number of trends. One is, of course, you've heard from others, the vulnerability. They're looking for vulnerable people. They're looking for those who are already dispossessed. So it is the poor. It is the marginalized. It's ethnic minorities, stateless people. And they want to take that one step further and actually disempower those people further, often by moving them across borders. And that's why, even though movement's not a requirement in trafficking, it often is seen in a trafficking scenario because that makes someone even more vulnerable. They're out of their home environment, they're in a new land, they don't know the language, the culture, the legal remedies that might be available to them. And then they put them through a bit of a mind wash to convince them that you are now a criminal. You are now committing actual crimes yourself. You're an illegal migrant, you're a girl in prostitution. These are all crimes, and if you try to seek help, you're going to be arrested. You're going to be the culprit. And that really is a tough thing to overcome. And whether we're dealing with police in India, prosecutors in Russia, or people here in the U.S., it really is the same thing of having to retool the way that we look at these people that would otherwise be seen as violators. Because, of course, as you've heard, ICE has a major role now, HSI, and one of their big mandates, of course, is to enforce immigration statutes. And we want to see those enforced. But having to overlook that and having to go, you know, beyond simply where you're, why don't you have papers, why are you out of status, but getting into their fears, the fears that traffickers have created. You know, why are you in fear? What do you think will happen to you if you try to get out of this situation? That's really what's required, and that is what leads ultimately to their freedom. For me, that is the element of compassion that's really behind, one, the U.S. government's approach, which is what we call a victim-centered approach, and really is what's required to forgive victims of these relatively minor crimes that were only committed because they were coerced into doing so or tricked into doing so. And I don't have the expertise in law enforcement, but what I hear from colleagues who do is that this is such a huge shift in approaches, the victim-centered approach, looking at a crime that's not fundamentally one that's committed against the government, like an immigration crime, or against society, like a prostitution crime. It's committed against an individual. It's very personal. And so in training law enforcement responders, you have to get personal. You have to talk about the individual stories, and you have to come down to the victim on a non-threatening level. You have to understand them that the first things out of their mouth may not be the truth, that it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of trust building, and ultimately the presentation of a viable exit strategy. How are you going to get out of there? You have to be able to assure them that by making themselves vulnerable, telling that story, saying I want to get out, that they will be able to get out. And so that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at in the report that we're producing and will come out in June, is victim identification, because it is so important and yet often overlooked. We've seen a lot of progress in the last 13 years since our national law was created. And those are in a variety of forms, new laws, new policies, more sophisticated approaches on treating victims. But that real, you know, that crucial ability to identify victims by responders. Because when not only is the victim denied freedom, when that interaction that occurs doesn't work, doesn't lead to identification, but they're often treated as a violator and then actually re-victimized or further harmed. And so we're going to be looking at a number of examples around the world of how things have worked well, some of the best practices, and how some of some of the problems that still exist, like I mentioned, looking at victims as violators, and how to deconflict immigration enforcement with victim identification.
Mark, that is great. Thank you. So you mentioned the word compassion, one of the hallmark characteristics of which Christians are supposed to be known. And so we're going to just ask a couple of panelists. And Jim, I want you to go first. Being a former pastor working in a Christian organization, so clearly you've got to have great theology on this. So just give us that snapshot idea of why should this particular issue of human trafficking matter to someone who is a Christian?
Yeah, let me just give four brief responses to that question. The first is that simply and maybe in its primal place, that we're commanded to care by a God who cares. So the reality is that there is no genre of scripture that does not address the issue of violence against the vulnerable in some form of sort of justice language. So biblical scholars like Christopher J. H. Wright will say very clearly and very openly that there is simply no, so justice is sort of the elephant in the room, because there just isn't any genre of scripture that doesn't address it. And we get God saying things like, this is about my identity. I am the God of justice who brought his people out of Egypt and rescued them. So that's one. God cares and wants his people to care. In some ways, it's part of the family DNA of the family of God. Two, my read on the New Testament is that Jesus actually hardwired the church for the life and death struggle of good and evil. And if we as the church abdicate from that struggle, we start to have an identity crisis. We wonder who we are and what we're put on earth for. So the idea of us reconnecting with the epic struggles of good and evil in our world, in our time, is actually breathes life back into the church and breathes hope and purpose back into the church, because that's what we're designed for. So that'd be reason number two. The Church of Jesus is hardwired for life and death struggle in the world. Third, that I've just come to, just to come to be aware of, is that biblical justice, when lived out by the church, is attractive to people who are otherwise skeptical about the church, right? It makes sense to people out there somewhere in the world that if anybody should care about this issue, my goodness, wouldn't it be church people? And if we engage and we actually are able to lead others in that engagement, it's tremendously attractive to them, because it just sort of makes sense on an intuitive gut level. And then the fourth thing, very simply, would be to say that God offers tremendous promises to us if we do engage. So just a quick selection from Isaiah 58, starting in verse 6, where God says through his prophet Isaiah to his people, "Is not this the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry?" You know some of this, I'm sure. Then he goes on, "If you do these things, then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly." This is verse 8. "Your vindicator shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry for help, and he will say, 'Here I am.'" Aren't these the very things that we desire from God? And he's saying these all of these things and more, if you read Isaiah 58, are yours if you will engage in the true fast that I've called you to, loosing the bonds of injustice, undoing the thongs of the yoke. So we're commanded to do it by a God who loves justice. The Church of Jesus is hardwired for just this kind of life and death struggle. It's attractive to people who are otherwise skeptical about the church, and God promises us wonderful things, beautiful things, if we will engage in this way.
See the preacher coming out in that guy, right? Sorry. I like working with that guy. Jim, that is really helpful, even for me, just to hear you say that again. But most of us, I mean, I would guess, don't work in a Christian mission for your primary place where you have been or are employed. And so, Veronica, maybe if you could go next on this. How do you integrate your Christian faith into the work you're doing? Why is it you're a deacon, but do you take off your deacon hat and then go to work for USAID? Or do you ever find there's integration in your faith for the work you do and your life as a Christian?
Well, first of all, Jim, thank you. That was really beautifully stated. and I think what I'll share is just maybe just talk about some scripture that resonates for me, in connection with this issue, and in connection with my daily life working on this. I'm going to mention Proverbs 31:8. "Speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute." So I was first introduced to this issue in 2002 when I was working in Senegal for UNICEF on child protection issues. And I was living in Dakar, the capital, and which is a very busy, bustling city. And I would leave my apartment every morning and be surrounded immediately by these children who were between the ages of 4 and 12 or 13. And they were barefoot, and many of them had sores on their heads. They were looked very malnourished, and they had these tin cans hanging from their neck, and they were begging for money or food to put into the tin cans. And many of them were deployed on the highway, on this big major throughway, weaving between cars, knocking on the car windows, begging for money and food. And I saw them every morning, day in and day out. And I learned that this was actually organized force begging, that these kids were recruited in groups by individuals who housed them at night in squalid conditions and deployed them in the day to go out and beg. And the organizer actually profited from, believe it or not, the coins and the money that these kids collected. And if these kids didn't bring in a certain quota of money, they were beaten. And they were so conspicuous. And I saw them every day. And this became connected to the work I was doing, obviously, on child protection. And I became very preoccupied with it. And what struck me really is that this is a whole population of kids that really does not have a voice at all. And exactly this is why this Proverbs speaks to me: you speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. And I think in my role in all of this, I have felt that is a driving motivation for me, that as I visit populations who are trafficked, whether they're, 12-year-olds in brothels, whether they're, children who are in mines far beneath the ground, chipping away in a dark hole all day, 12, 13, 14 hours. These are all people who whose story is unknown and who are miles away from lawmakers in their own country and lawmakers and policymakers here in Washington who can do something about it. So actually when I was working in Mark's office on the Trafficking in Persons report, it was very meaningful for me to be able to contribute to the writing of that report, because that report documents the stories of these people and gives recommendations to governments all over the world for what they need to do to help these people, and provides assistance to help those countries do that. So that's been meaningful for me. And I also just wanted to mention Deuteronomy 10:18, the Lord executes justice for the fatherless and the widow and loves the sojourner, the foreigner. Giving him food and clothing. I want to mention that because it really speaks to me, because the people who are so vulnerable to being trafficked really are the fatherless, very often children who are separated from their families, sometimes during conflict or in a wide variety of situations, children who've lost their families and are just out on the street. Those are the ones the traffickers prey on. Widows are classic vulnerable group to trafficking. Many women, when they lose their husbands, in many cultures, they have no source of income and they're destitute and they're very vulnerable to being trafficked, particularly for sex. And of course, the sojourner, the foreigner. So many trafficking victims are migrants looking for opportunities. They leave their own country and they look for work in another economy. And these are prime populations who are vulnerable to this crime. And it's, again, at USAID, where I've been managing programs to provide for these vulnerable populations to prevent trafficking or assistance to survivors, it's been very much with a focus for these particular vulnerable populations.
Good. Some of you are getting questions in. It's great. Quinn's picking them up, delivering to me. And so if you have a question, you can get those down. So we're going to hear Amanda's answer, and then we'll transition into some of your questions. So tell us your story of how faith and your profession interact around this issue.
Well, when I first got involved in prosecuting of human trafficking, it wasn't really by choice. It was kind of a, you're the lowest person on the totem pole. Here you go. Here's some extra work. And I actually, when I first was involved, for the first 2 years, I was convinced it was a woman's right issue. As far as every victim that I saw was a woman, and it was always that she was being exploited. And I didn't like that as a woman, that's what I was seeing. And then I met an individual, I can't give you her name because it's currently being investigated, but she's from an Asian country and was brought over through the New York circuit. So she came in through JFK and then was brought down to work in a massage parlor. And she's much older than I am, has a family back in her home country. And when the officer went in, they have to go in and do a bust. They have to get her to be a prostitute, essentially. That's how they rescue her. So she does it. They whisk her back. We got her into a victim service house. And when I remember speaking to my detective, my investigator, and he said, you know, the second that she realized who we were, she just fell down and started praying. And it shook me a little bit because I had never really thought of this as anything involving my faith. And I went to go visit her the first time, and she and I hit it off. We definitely got along very well, and she wouldn't tell me what happened to her. And I had to keep going back and going back and going back, and we kept having the same conversation. I was like, you just need to tell me what happened to you. And finally I just said, you know what, can we just pray? And it's not something I'm supposed to do in my job. It's not, you know, mixing of government and the church is never a good thing. But so we did. And that was the moment that changed it for me. Here was a woman who, again, much older than I am. She didn't have any education. She had no money. She had children back in her home country. She had no options. And she was asking me, even if it wasn't outright, if I would be her voice, if I could stand up for her. Because this person had exploited her for years, and she couldn't do it on her own. And it opened my eyes to what my job, maybe the reason that God introduced this in my life. Maybe it didn't have so much to do with women's rights, as much as I love to champion them. Maybe it had something more to do with, you know, God giving me the strength when other people are weak. And I feel like as part of my faith, that's my job. You know, God has given me this strength, and God has given me the job that I have and the education that I have and the opportunities that I had so that I can help people that are vulnerable and people that can't stand up for themselves. I know it's kind of been said before already. I'm sorry. I'm reiterating what the people have said. But it also changed the way that I looked at prosecution. You know, prosecution, in my mind, can't always be defined as how much jail time we get someone. That's not a success for me anymore. In these cases, it's really how many victims can I help? How many victims can I get out of harm's way? And specifically, you know, when we do get jail time, it's wonderful because I feel like I'm finally protecting the possible victims that this person could bring into this lifestyle. And it's changed the way that I look at my own faith. It's changed the way that I look at my job, and it's definitely strengthened my relationship with Christ. And I can't say that I pray with every victim, but it has given me the opportunity to outreach. Even if I'm not saying it overtly, you know, my Christianity is coming through, my faith is coming through, and I hope that they see that. So that's what I would say.
Well, that's good. Thank you. And I think that's something that could probably translate to a lot of our careers in different professions or volunteer services or even how we parent or grandparent or aunt and uncle, just that awareness of the needs that are there and what God puts before us. You did mention this idea around prosecution, which touches on a question that some people are wondering about. You're all very eloquently speaking about the victims, but what about the other side? Some of our group are wondering about the perpetrators. This is a profitable industry because there are customers who pay for it. And so what's being done, or how do you kind of think of it or tackling this problem from the demand side? What are some effective examples of shutting down the traffickers? Maybe just two of you could answer. Take a run at that.
Sure. I mean, demand is a very you know, very important issue, but it's often difficult to define on sex trafficking, it's a bit easier. And there, obviously, you heard about Backpage, and there are a lot of outlets that seek to build demand for the services of trafficked women and girls in sexual slavery. And there's a growing movement to try to shut that down through both through legislative action and just sheer pressure, economic pressure on those that try to provide those services. And there's just a growing awareness. I know some celebrities have done this, some church groups have done this, of putting the word out that real men don't buy sex, and trying to eliminate that at local levels in the U.S. and I know in some countries overseas. The clients of prostitution have their identities revealed in newspapers, or required to go to John's schools in some parts of the U.S. where they're told about sex trafficking and how they're contributing to this problem of slavery. So those are some of the ways that deal with the demand side on sex trafficking. On forced labor, that's where it's much more diverse, because there are just so many things that are produced, not just tangibles, but also services. And it really covers the gamut. But one of the things, the initiatives that we've seen are efforts to force companies to ensure that their supply chains are clean of slave labor. And the California last year passed the California Supply Transparency Act, I think it's called, which isn't that tough, but it at least creates the basic requirement that any company dealing in trade in California, and I think the threshold is quite low, has to at least state that they either have a policy to ensure that slave labor is outside of their supply chain, or articulate that policy. And so that's publicized. And so that's an initial requirement. And we see others around the world that are trying to do that. The Australians just announced efforts to have the same sort of thing with a little more teeth in it.
Yeah, I think I would just love to say that all efforts are welcome at the table. I think we're talking about the things that we know and the places where we're involved in the issue, and I think that all comers are welcome to deal with whatever side of the problem they'd like to address. So we should talk more about the demand side. I think also it's important to inject hope into the conversation, because this is just a normal Wednesday night, and some of you may be a little bit just overwhelmed by the how deeply we're going into a dark issue here. So one of the things that we learned over time was, as International Justice Mission, doing this work on the ground in 10 different countries and 16 different field offices, is that there is just a remarkable overall deterrent effect when you can actually start to prosecute people. So we weren't able to actually to document this until recently, but we had this experience of working in Cambodia, of working in Thailand, on the issues of minors forced into prostitution. And if you think about this, right, it's an interesting thing, right? Because a brothel is a business, and identifying the people being exploited in that business, the children being raped for profit, should be easy, right? Because if the clients can find it, then the police should be able to find it. But it becomes much more complicated because people are complicit in keeping it going and all those sorts of things, right? So over the years of running these operations for 2 or 3 years with local law enforcement, we would have this experience of having it become harder and harder to find minors, but weren't able to document that until we opened a new office in the Philippines. So just the short story to illustrate the overall deterrent effect and to inject a little bit of hope into the conversation tonight is to say that we opened an office for the express under a grant from the Gates Foundation for the express purpose to test this theory that the overall deterrent effect actually protects a large number of minors in the population. So we did an initial study before we started working and doing our casework in this Tri-City area in the Philippines where we'd never worked before, identified the level of victimization of minors, and then began working cases in this in a 4-year cycle. We rescued somewhere around 225 young girls over the course of 2 or 3 years in this operation, began to prosecute some of the crimes, executed only about 100 arrests. And then we had a group of independent criminologists come in and assess what was different 4 years later, we were hoping to be able to prove a 20% reduction in the victimization of minors over 4 years. We thought that would actually say something. What ended up happening, and this is documented under something called Project Lantern, is we didn't find a 20% reduction, a 79% reduction in the number of minors available in the commercial sex industry was what independent criminologists were able to document. So there is actually significant hope that's just starting to surface in the work from our perspective that we see. And this is again, just from the law enforcement approach side.
I just wanted to add briefly that USAID supports programs to address demand as well, and one that I might just highlight very briefly is a program actually also in the Philippines that we supported, where we worked with youth groups, young men, and educated them about trafficking, viewing them as potential procurers of commercial sex in future. And a lot of young people really do not know that there are women who are, and girls who are in prostitution unwillingly. And when they find out that there's forced prostitution, it affects their behavior, you know, as procurers of commercial sex. And that's something that I think is, you know, is not just an overseas program, but certainly could be done with youth groups in the U.S. that could affect behavior.
And to say also, I think it's incumbent upon us as the church, when we talk about things like pornography, that we not do it in a way that's sort of separated off and in quiet places in the church. We need to be calling ourselves to account as a church and making the connection between the issue of sex addiction and pornography and what's actually going on in the world. As much as we may not want to look at either of those things, we need to actually look at them both and connect the two.
All right, so we're coming up close to 8 o'clock, and this is a really important question for us to kind of land on. As a church or several individuals are wondering, and so I'm taking the question that got the most votes, more or less, to finish the panel tonight. And Amanda, you're specifically, you have to answer this because it says they want to hear from you on this, but then maybe if one or two others want to just jump in quickly. Someone wants to know really from you, is it possible that someone doing something like cleaning our houses, like a Latino woman, maybe perhaps, is being trafficked? And if so, how do we know what we can do? So what are the signs of trafficking to be aware of in the community, and what can, like, National Perez members do to help identify victims?
So the easy, well, the, not the easy answer. The answer to the first part of the question is it possible that this person was trafficked? The answer is, of course, yes. So the question is, was she trafficked? And there's a difference, and it's a whole federal definition between smuggling and trafficked. So just because she's here and she was smuggled across the border doesn't mean that she was trafficked here to work. So you first have to ask yourself the question is she doing the work in your home willingly? Is there an element of force, fraud, or coercion there? How did she get there? Is she working for someone else? Is she giving the money to someone else? What we often see in our trafficking cases is really that someone else always speaks for her. So if there's always somebody else kind of there, if you know, there's always someone there and he takes the money and then she comes in and cleans the house and then leaves. If you're asking her questions, if she's evasive, it's a lot of the same signs as you've probably heard of domestic violence victims. They're introverted. They don't want to talk to you. Even if you straight out ask her, you know, are you being trafficked? Do you need help? She may say no because of the threats that she's received from the person that's trafficking her. Now, as far as what a church community can do, there are so many things that a church can do. And the first step is sitting in an organization or an organized forum like this and listening to it, because I think a lot of people don't realize that it's actually happening. And opening your eyes, so when you're looking around, you're seeing what's going on around you. I know in Baltimore County, we have a lot of NGOs that rely on people volunteering their time, volunteering their money to come out and help. So I would, you know, definitely tell you to look for those organizations. I know Polaris is nearby. They have a hotline where people actually sit and give up, you know, hours of their time in the evening so that if young girls, young boys, or other trafficking victims call in, that they're there to answer the phone and get them help. Where we live, there's an organization called Turnaround, and they actually rely on people that are willing to open their homes, which I know sometimes is a risk, so don't, you know, go definitely be a little bit, you know, consider what you're doing before you say yes. But in instances where there are juveniles, we have no place to house these young girls when they're picked up. So it's a question of, you know, opening your homes to them. And really just opening your minds to what's happening is the most important thing. You know, making the phone call when it needs to be made. Don't stand by and let injustice happen right in front of you. Definitely say something. You know, that's the big thing now. If you see something, say something. It's the same thing for human trafficking because you're the first line of defense. You're out on the streets. I'm in an office all day. So, you know, if you see something in front of you, if you see a group of young girls at the mall and they kind of look like they shouldn't be there or something's not quite right, just say something to them or let the security guard know, like, hey, there's something going on over there that I don't think is quite right. There are lots of people, the second that there is a complaint made, for example, in the national, I'm going to get the wording wrong, it's called NCMEC, the Exploited Child Network, essentially. The second there is a complaint, and you can complain, you can file a complaint online, you can just send an email to them. There are so many people on that that know what they're looking for, that know what they're doing, and it really does help.
National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Thank you. I knew that. Acronym. I didn't know the word.
They're here in D.C. also. All right. Before any of you jump in, it's 8-ish, and I have permission from Quinn and David to just stand and take a short stretch break. If you need to leave, it's 8 o'clock, by all means do. If you'd like to stick around for 15 more minutes or so with this amazing panel, I've got a few more questions to ask. But we'll just take a short stand-up break, and then we'll sit back down and go for about 15 more minutes for those of you who can stay. Questions, and so I'm just going to raise the one of these questions kind of thematically come up really, and Jim and Mark, you guys might be able to give us the best expertise on this, but questions around this idea of the rule of law and rampant corruption in a lot of these places. How does the actual identification of victims take place? And so Mark, maybe you could answer from the tip office perspective, and then Jim, maybe you can answer from the IJM perspective, how they identify, we identify clients. So, Mark, tell us how our clients or how our victims are identified without a rule of law and just rampant corruption.
Well, in those environments, and there are plenty of them, where rule of law is just broken down and, through corruption, through lack of political will, it's really civil society and faith institutions that step in and identify victims. And what's been remarkable to see in the last decade is the number of organizations that have particularly helped victims access justice when they normally would just have no hope whatsoever. And IJM is a great organization at doing that, to come into a country and not to try to change the legal system, but most of these places already, they do have tools, they're just not being used. They've been allowed to atrophy, and there's no access to them. And just connect victims with those through, you know, often, you know, very, very laborious efforts to provide legal counseling and stay in court and push their cases. But it's that kind of thing, strategic litigation, that's going to break that lack of rule of law free. It's going to actually establish that justice, you know, a path towards justice that others can follow.
Yeah, so I can answer from IJM's perspective. As a small NGO, we're about 550 people strong. Many of those 550 people actually are investigators, Christians who are career law enforcement, military, who have investigative expertise. And they actually go in various cases around the world in sex trafficking instances, posing as clients, wearing undercover camera equipment, will go in and actually solicit a minor for sex. Won't actually complete the action, of course, but will sit with the minor in a room and begin to talk to her about, how old do you think you are? Have you been forced into this situation? Would you leave if you could? You know, those sort of things. Capturing all that on video and then working with local secure police contacts so that within the realm of local law, the law then that is usually in most of the places we're working actually quite good, quite robust, then can be enforced on behalf of the victim who has no voice and no access to it. So that's the role. So we're lawyers, investigators, and aftercare workers who are going in, discovering the victims, documenting their stories, building the legal case, and then compelling the justice system to take action. And it takes time. It takes sometimes a huge amount of effort. But our experience over the last, we're just turned 16 years old. Our experience over the last 16 years is that the wheels even of some of the rustiest public justice systems around the world can indeed begin to turn. With effort and constant application and a lot of elbow grease, it actually does begin to work. You begin to get first compel the police actually to take action, and then compel the police actually to begin to arrest perpetrators. These things happen usually dominoes falling after one another. And then actually compelling the court system to take the cases on. And then you actually start to get convictions after a while. So we just recently, about a month ago, landed a landmark conviction in India of a kingpin trafficker that just took forever for us to get him arrested. It was one of the more brutal cases we've ever encountered. And then to get the court to take the case seriously. He was a very, very connected individual. For the time that he was in jail, the roughly 14 months, I think, that he was in jail, he applied for bail over 80 times. Complicating this is that the Indian court system has no way of notifying or doesn't notify when someone applies for bail. So what that involved for us was sending a lawyer to the court every single day to read through the docket to see if an application for bail had been submitted. 81 or 82 times it had, and we had to mobilize to make sure that the man was, because he would have disappeared if he had received bail. So that's what it looks like. It's on the ground. It's not particularly glamorous. Often it's a lot of hard work, and it's fairly boring. But that's what it takes, and it does actually work.
Good. This is another question that's kind of come up a thread in a few of these. And I think all four of you might have a different voice, and so you might have to give a one-minute answer so we can get all of this in. But and this might be someplace we could inject some hope into this discussion, too. The idea is around, is there a favorable trend in governments or in our government in getting involved in dealing with these trafficking issues, or is it dominantly NGOs that are doing the work and the activity? And if it is the NGOs, are they actually able to raise the funds that they need to attack this problem? So I think, Veronica, your work now with USAID might be the most to give us a sense of globally, is there a sense of governments moving there, or is it NGOs, and can the NGOs get what they need funding? So, and all of you, if you have something, we'd love to hear from all of you on that with brief answers.
I'll just mention that I've always been impressed by IJM's budget. It far exceeds ours at USAID. So... Well, I maybe my numbers are off. I mean, we at USAID we spend on average about $16.5 million annually. So I don't know if you want to disclose, but in any case, I think you have more money than we do.
Happy to disclose.
But what I'm seeing as a trend is that closer coordination actually between government and NGOs as we move into the future. And actually, I'll waive this, which is recommendations that just were released last week by the president has an advisory council of faith-based and neighborhood partnerships, they call it. So it's faith-based organizations and civil society organizations that work on this issue, and they've come together. And they've given recommendations, basically, to the president. And some of these recommendations are that, in fact, Congress give the government more money to address this issue. And so NGOs are really advocating for a more aggressive role for the government. And at the same time, through groups like this, because this is a White House group that encompasses faith-based organizations and civil society organizations, through this groups like this, which are joint government NGO, we're seeing a very, very, very powerful response to this issue. And I know at USAID, we just had an NGO consultation last week where we pulled together a group of NGOs, and we basically said, here's what we're thinking of doing, give us some feedback. And we've been doing that constantly to try to build rapport, learn from NGOs, so that we can all be in this together. And I think that's a very positive trend, because it hasn't been the case I've, you know, been doing this for about 10 years. It was not the case in the beginning. There was not as strong a partnership. So I think that's a positive trend.
In Maryland, we have a wonderful governor who, when he was first asked the question, which is when he was running for, I think, his first election in the state, he was asked by one of the people that is now on our task force, is there a problem in Maryland, or how are you addressing the problem in Maryland of human trafficking? And his response was, do we have that here? Mm. Now, for the past 2 years, and especially one coming up next month, he holds conferences on human trafficking. He has a member of his crime office, crime prevention office, that sits on our task force. Locally in my office, it was the same kind of thing. It's not a problem here, not a problem here, not a problem here. We're not going to waste resources on this. And now they've specially assigned a prosecutor that's handling it. So I definitely think that local governments are starting to see this. It is a interesting topic. It's a topic that people get behind very easily because it is vulnerable victims. But at the same time, I think that they're actually doing it for the right reasons. What I've seen is, although we don't have a lot of funding in Maryland, unfortunately, a lot of our state employees are being furloughed. We are seeing that they are putting some money behind this. We are starting to get some grants from the federal government for our task force. So I definitely have seen a positive trend as far as our government's involvement in this issue, because I think if the government ignores it and we don't have law enforcement on board, it's just going to perpetuate the problem.
Quickly, I will say we're thrilled and very, very hopeful by several signs. One has been all along the U.S. government has been very, very helpful and cooperative and very encouraging with our little NGO effort, which in the last couple of years, it's actually true, has not become so little. So the other thing that's very encouraging is that our organization, by the generosity of Christian people, largely has grown at about 20% per year for 16 years. So our budget last year was about $36 million. By God's grace, this year we expect it to be up about $45 million. So that sort of growth we have been very thankful for. We're also beginning to experience, I would say, unprecedented cooperation in some of the places, from some of the governments in the places where we're working, including India, including the Philippines. And a lot of that is because we've gotten so much help from the U.S. government and support in the work that we're doing via the TIP report and those sort of things. Super helpful. And then finally, I would say I am just so deeply encouraged by the response of the church, especially over the last 10 years. 15 years ago, there weren't these kind of conversations going on a Wednesday night. And there just are more and more and more of them now, and I find that so very deeply encouraging.
Excellent. Well, we are at 8:15, and I've not been able to get to all your questions, in part because we have so much expertise up here. But let's just finish with one more kind of final statement. And what I'd like you all to just sort of capture, if you could, and I've written down, if you don't have an answer, I've already written down your answer for you. So how, if someone hears from a church, what do they take from this? Or how do they individually get personally involved and connected in the fight? Or how might they help this church or the church where they normally worship become a church that's active in the work of justice and fighting human trafficking? Like I said, I have your answer here if you don't know what it could be. So I'd love to see if you get the right answer.
I just say I wish somebody should write a book on that. On
we
that
happen
subject.
To have that, actually.
Just to say, at IJM, we have just deeply loved the church and the church's response and been hopeful and full of vision about what local churches can do. So for me, there is no short answer because there is a lot that churches can do and a lot that churches have done, from becoming experts on issues of injustice in their own community to working with IJM and other partners to start aftercare homes for trafficking survivors in India, for example. A lot of those stories are told in the book, but there just is a ton that can be done by just your average person who would go to a meeting at a church, say, on a Wednesday night.
Okay, Mark, you would say you should all read the TIP report when it comes out.
Yes, it'll come out in June. We don't have a precise date yet, but probably middle to late June. And look at our website. Look at DOJ or HHS's website, and you'll see phone numbers, organizations that are grantees of ours and other agencies. Look at AID's tip page. And you can see the work that's being done by a lot of great organizations, faith-based and non, and you know, seek out information from them. See what they need, volunteering or contributing through money or just helping them get the word out. Awareness is still a key part of the response. It's the way of turning people around and getting them to start seeing this through a new lens.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Veronica, as a deacon of this church, you had mentioned one thing to me. You thought maybe National Pres itself could even be involved. Was it in that panel response, or you had an idea earlier?
I did. one thing that comes to mind is I'm going to throw out a website with a lot of volunteer opportunities, which is called endslaverynow.org. So you can go on there, and certainly that can be part of the church's community outreach. There are a whole bunch of opportunities for people to go and volunteer to address this issue. I think maybe the other issue we were talking about, but it's a bit indirect, is just to be aware of sort of the whole myriad of social justice, biblical justice issues, and how they feed into this issue. And that I had mentioned to Joe a story about a victim who my office had helped rescue, and the victim had told her story. She was a 13-year-old who was in a brothel being prostituted and in Africa, and her story about how she got into it was a story of somebody who, her father died when she was 11 because he didn't have access to health care. Her mother didn't have an education or any skills to support the family, so she ended up going from her village to the city to get a job. To help support the family. She worked for very little in the marketplace. As a child, after doing that for a year, a pimp approached her, and said, if you come work for me in my establishment, I can give you, lots of money. And she ended up following him as a 12-year-old at that point into a brothel where she was forced into prostitution. And the story just illustrates that all the contributing factors that leads someone into a trafficking situation are the whole span of social justice issues that the church deals with, combating poverty and providing opportunities to people that don't have them, and issues surrounding providing health care to people. All of those feed into this issue, and I guess just for the church to be aware in social justice programs and in outreach that that these issues are all interconnected, and some of the other activities that you are doing in the community are indeed preventing this, and also just to keep this in everybody's mind as you go out into the community, and as Amanda was saying, listen to people, and if they seem like they're being controlled by somebody or afraid to talk about their employer, or if somebody is standing behind them when they come to church and they clearly look like they don't have freedom of movement, or they're not free to associate with or contact the people they want to, they're probably a trafficking victim. So as you go out into the community and do your other work with food pantries or communities or helping poor people, I would say keep in your mind that these victims are out there and you can help identify them.
And one of our volunteer leaders in Philadelphia for IJM said that whenever she goes to get a manicure or pedicure now, she always engages in conversation, and she always asks the question, what do you like to do on your day off? And if the person can't answer the question, that's one indication that they might not ever have a day off. So simple things like that are places that could be right at our, literally, at our feet, and we might not know it if we don't engage with questions of awareness. So Amanda's going to give us one final idea about her opinion of a best place or way to get educated about local ideas of human trafficking.
Well, there's a couple of really good films that I would recommend that you see. One of them is called Very Young Girls. It was actually put out by Showtime. It's an excellent movie, and it talks about both demand and the victim's perspective. And they have it on, I think about on Amazon. Also, I mean, CNN, they've put out a wonderful array of things. I think it's Lisa Ling does them, and she goes, it's local and international, but she does some great things on local, especially massage parlors. She really takes you inside and shows you the conditions that these victims are living in. There's a wonderful organization that I've worked really close with called Shared Hope International. They're based in Alexandria, and they have a kind of a subgroup called the Defenders, and it's actually men that kind of take on a role of either protector as far as the victims or as far as educating other young men about sex trafficking so that it doesn't happen to another young girl or young boy. Also, I mentioned it, but Turnaround is a local group that we have, and they do a lot of trainings, as does Shared Hope, for just people. You know, you don't have to be a part of an NGO. You don't have to be part of the government or law enforcement. It's just for the community. Because it's really about, I know we've all touched on this, but it's really just about awareness.
Excellent. Thank you all so much for your expertise and your time and what you've given us.
We are just so grateful. Wow. Each week the topic has convicted me, and tonight has been no exception by a long shot. We knew that we couldn't cover every issue in an hour or an hour and 15 minutes even, and we won't in the coming weeks when we look at Christians in peace in the Middle East, at refugees, at Christians in Egypt, and the other topics. But all of these are ways for us to begin to raise issues, to see what the Holy Spirit might do with us. And I think that this is probably not the last time that we will address this particular topic. And so I think we can count on that. We will begin to list resources on our church website that of articles, the movies, some of the other links that you have mentioned where we can get the reports and things like that for each of our evenings. So we'll go to work on that. If your name is Sarah and you're missing your Kindle Fire, I've found it. and would you join me in prayer as we close our evening? Gracious God, you sent your Son to deliver us from bondage, to save the world, to bring justice. And we are your adopted children, and we have a relationship with you through him. And we are deeply convicted this evening that to follow you is to be about the same work that you are about. And so we simply would ask that you would lead each of us and that you would lead all of us as Christians and as your church in the way that we should go in this particular issue of human slavery, which you abhor, but every issue. And all of these are related. And so would you guide us. And we're counting on you to provide our vision. And we ask all this in your blessing as we go to our homes. In Jesus' name, amen.